Good morning, and welcome to our first session from Kansas City Jazz to Delta Blues. I'm Steve Weiss. I'm the curator of the Southern Folklife Collection at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's an honor to chair this session, which focuses on two towering and innovative figures in the history of American music, Charlie Parker and Robert Johnson, and features some exciting work from our ARSC members, Chuck Haddix and Seth Winter. Some housekeeping. We'll take questions following the two presentations. So let's not waste any more time, and I'll introduce our first speaker. Chuck Haddix is the director of the Mar Sound Archives, a collection of 340,000 historic sound recordings housed at the Miller Nichols Library at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Haddix hosts The Fish Fry, a popular radio program featuring the finest in blues, soul, rhythm and blues, jumping jive, and zydeco on KCUR.org, FM 89.3, Kansas City's public radio station, Friday and Saturday nights from 8 o'clock to midnight. Over the years, Haddix has contributed to a wide variety of theatrical recording, video, and film projects, including Cronkite Remembers, a biography of Walter Cronkite, Robert Altman's Kansas City, and Merchant Ivory's Mr. and Mrs. Bridge. His articles have appeared in Downbeat and Living Blues magazine. In 2005, he co-authored with Frank Driggs A History of Kansas City Jazz, Kansas City Jazz from Ragtime to Bebop, a history for Oxford University Press. His biography of Charlie Parker, Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker, will be published in the fall of 2013 by the University of Illinois Press. His presentation today is Early Bird, The Life, Career, and Recordings of Charlie Parker in Kansas City. Please welcome Chuck Haddix.
Yeah, I'm really delighted to be here. It's kind of funny because I was reflecting on the first ARS conference. I think it was in Kansas City. I think it was 1988. And that's where I had the pleasure of meeting so many good friends that unfortunately are no longer with us. I think about Phil Rockland and Fred Williams, and most recently Elwood McKee's passing. But it's nice to see that the torch has been picked up by a new generation. And it's also nice to see so many women involved, because in the early days that wasn't always the case. And also, I want to recognize a couple of friends here that really made this happen, and that's Sandy Rodriguez and Kelly Martin, and also Roberta Schwartz back here. That's your team. Stand up, guys. You deserve a hand. You did some great work here. Andrew, you might as well stand up, too. And our newest member of ARSC, Andrew Hansborough, he just started working for the Sound Archive full-time. He's our utility man. And while you're here in Kansas City, remember, as Milton Morris used to say, drive fast, talk back to the police, and tell them you know me. It worked for Sam Barlowski. This new biography of Charlie Parker is an outgrowth of the research I did for my book, Kansas City Jazz from Ragtime to Bebop. As part of the process, I went through the Kansas City Call and indexed the years from 1919 to 1943. And what I found was, it had never been done before, what I found was there were lots of references to Charlie Parker in Kansas City, and there's lots of myths about Charlie Parker, about his relationship with his hometown, how he didn't want to be buried here, he hated Kansas City. That wasn't the case. He often came home to Kansas City. And so I was able to kind of dispel a lot of those myths in this new biography. And if you want to take a look at it, the page proofs are on the table of the University of Illinois Press. And that's what the cover looks like. That's a shot of him at Billy Berg's. Originally, there were 11 chapters in my Kansas City book, and I said, I think I'll save these last two chapters and do something with it. And so over the years, I've been working on this, and the University of Illinois Press, who is wonderful to work with, has been kind enough to publish it. One of the interesting things about previous biographies, because when you're writing a biography, of course, you've got to check the existing literature, is they are largely overlooked his formative years here in Kansas City, which is kind of ironic because he spent his first 21 years living in Kansas City, and then he moved on to New York where he died at the age of 34. And I think to look at the growth of any artist or any individual, you have to look at their childhood. And I also had access to a lot of his childhood friends, And being from Kansas City, you know, I know the territory quite well. It's hard to write about Kansas City if you're you're not from here, because there's certain cultural and social things that you, subtleties that you miss out on. Of course, Kansas City and New York share the life and legacy of Charlie Parker. New York has been a much better steward of Charlie Parker than we have. We have a 21 sacks salute at his grave on his birthday. New York celebrates Charlie Parker with a wonderful festival. And they've laid claim to Charlie Parker, but it's a shared legacy. And in 1939, after apprenticing with Lester Young and Buster Smith here in Kansas City, Charlie made the musical breakthrough he'd been seeking while jamming at a chili parlor, Wall's Chili Parlor in Harlem. And then subsequently, he came back to Kansas City, where he lived until 1941. But during those early years, he was really drifting in and out of here. Ironically, while Charlie made his musical breakthrough in New York City, it was the recordings he made here in Kansas City and Wichita from 1940 to 1943 that best document his evolving genius as an improviser. The first disc he recorded that's been documented is called Honey and Body. It's known as Honey and Body. It's a rare, flowing, unaccompanied solo that interpolates Honeysuckle Rose and Body and Soul. The provenance of the disc is a little murky. Carol Jenkins, who's a local musician, who's a childhood friend of Charlie Parker's, got the disc from Charlie's mother, Addie. And he had it on his wall for a long time. And it was recorded by a trumpeter named Clarence Davis, although I suspect it may have been recorded at the Wonderland Arcade down on 12th Street here, Kansas City. Because I'd always heard from the Gold Cats that were around that Bird liked to go down there and record himself. They had a recording booth in there. So that may be the provenance, too. Carol Jenkins claimed it was recorded in 1937. Carl Woydeck, he dates the disc from 1940. I think I'll agree with Carl Woydeck on this one. However, Honeysuckle Rose had been in Parker's repertoire since at least 1936. It also played a key role in his development as a musician. Reno Club was located at 12th and Cherry, and they had a spook breakfast, a jazz jam that started at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday and went all day on Monday. Charlie Parker used to like to hang out in the balcony above the bandstand where all the musicians were smoking reefers, and he could get high just sitting in the balcony. And he also liked to hang out in the back, and he had a lot of interaction with the older musicians who mentored him along. That was a Kansas City tradition. Well, this jam session was for professionals only. I mean, you know, you're talking Lester Young, Lips Page, Joe Jones, Walter Page, some of the greatest musicians of their generation. Well, Parker decided one night he was going to sit in, and while soloing on Honeysuckle Rose, he faltered. And to show his displeasure, Joe Jones threw a cymbal at his feet. There's a lot of talk about this on the internet, whether it actually happened or not, but Gene Ramey, who was a reliable narrator, the most reliable narrator of Kansas City Jazz, was there that night, and he recalled it quite clearly. So I'll go with Gene Ramey on that one. And then he retreated to his home, where he woodshedded, reportedly playing as much as 12 hours a day. And then in Thanksgiving 1936, he was on his way to Mooser's Ozark Tavern. There was a horrible wreck. He broke his back and his ribs. And he recovered over that next year, and then went back to Mooser's in 1937 and spent the summer down there woodshedding. The musicians had to stay on site because it's Little Dixie. There's a lot of sundown communities where African Americans ventured at their own peril after dark. And Mooser's was a nice resort. And then he came back a musically changed man. That's one of the first of his epiphanies. In December of 1938, he performed Honeysuckle Rose as a member of the Harlan Leonard Band on a program called the Vine Street Varieties. It was broadcast over WHB. His version of Body and Soul was probably inspired by Coleman Hawkins' recording from October 1939, although Buster Smith recalled that it was his repertoire earlier. Buster Smith recalled in 1937 and 1938 how Charlie Parker would get together with these, believe it or not, young white musicians, Charlie White, Bud Calvert, and they would jam on tunes like Body and Soul and play the hard changes on that. And according to, he said, it's really how you learn to play the horn. Change all them chords and keys and playing on key and moving a half a tone up and all that kind of stuff. They called it going out of key in the old days here in Kansas City. According to Carl Woidak, listening to Honeybody, it becomes apparent that even at this young age, I'm quoting here, Charlie Parker had a highly developed sense of swing. Even without a rhythm section, the performance has a pleasing forward motion and drive. Woidak adds, the Parker fairly liberally plays phrases that cut across the 8-bar section of Honeysuckle Rose. It's more associated with his work from 1943 than with his early recordings such as this. Clearly, with this recording, Charlie was well on his way to developing bebop when he was only 20 years old. The older musicians, according to Claude Williams, they all call it crazy music here in Kansas City. This is a pretty rough recording. The disc itself is in Kansas City. It's in a safe deposit box. It's owned by Carol Jenkins' son. And Steve Simoleon actually did a transfer of it at one point. This is not Steve's transfer. This is the one that's been circulated. This is a short version. Let's hear a Body of Honey Body. As Monty Python says, sorry, Squire, your record's stuck. There's two different versions of that. That was the short version. I thought we had a longer version in the library, but unfortunately we didn't. But you can hear the emerging genius of Charlie Parker there, and some of his signatures, too, like quoting T for Two. For some reason, he loved that song. He often quoted it in his music. Later that year, Parker recorded both numbers again during the Thanksgiving 1940 weekend engagement at the Trocadero Club in Wichita, Kansas. Fred Higginson, a young jazz fan who worked for radio KFBI, recorded the band to Lacker's in two late night sessions. This is kind of an interesting story behind this. I was able to shed new light on this thanks to a gift to the library. The provenance of the recordings, once again, is kind of murky. Copies were given to Jay McShann. He put them in the closet and basically forgot about them until 1959. And Frank Driggs convinced Gene Ramey to get the discs from Jay. Gene Ramey picked up the discs, and Frank played them on Martin Williams' radio program, and there were tapes made of them at that point. And then according to Frank, I asked him about this. I asked him, I said, what happened to the discs? He goes, well, he disappeared. He didn't want to talk about what happened to the discs. They're probably residing in a private collection, maybe at the Library of Congress or someplace like that. But one of the things about the reissues is they had not been able to nail, no one knew what order they were because they're recorded to 10-inch discs, right? And they've been shuffled around, and so this is the standard listing at the top there of the order of the disc, and actually that's not the way it went down. I was contacted a few years ago by Charlie Higginson, Fred's son, and he was going through a filing cabinet, and he came across the sign-in sheet for the session, and you can see Charles Parker, alto, one of the few times he signed his name Charles, usually it was always Charlie. And so it gives the personnel, Bob Maybain is not listed in the personnel on the reissues, but he obviously was there, and it talks about which tune he was in. He almost threw the folder away, and he opened it just by chance. So this was almost, a lot of history's been lost that way. And also, he came up with the set list that gives the date for the two recording sessions and the order things were played with the personnel. You know, we've got a good engineer here that documents that. This, we've got it up on the web on our website if you want to see it. But this constitutes really a major breakthrough. Now, the first session featured an octet from the big band in the wee hours of Saturday, November 30th. And as you can see from the photo, what's interesting, it's always thought that these recordings were done in a studio. They were actually weren't. They were probably done in a music room at the university there in Wichita. They weren't done in the studio. This is a picture of the session. You can see Bird there. That's Bob Maybain. That's Step Buddy Anderson behind him. That's Orville Piggy Minor to the left, and that's Jay on keyboards. That's from the, incidentally, that's from the Jay McShann collection. It's a heck of a thing what we do when we collected collections from friends of ours. You know, Jay McShann always lit up a room. He was larger than life. When I went to pick up his collection, there it was in file cabinets, and he was gone. It made me very sad until I looked at his passports and know how much he traveled. Legend has it he kept a packed suitcase by the door just in case he got that call for a gig. So that's the set list right there. Now, the interesting thing is, Charlie's solo flights on Body and Soul and Moat and Swing showcase his advanced technique and ideas. On Body and Soul, he runs in and out of key while maintaining a ballad tempo. Following Charlie's leads, Buddy Anderson and other band members shift to double time before resuming the ballad tempo in the out chorus. Let's hear a little taste of Body and Soul there, Fred. Why don't you go ahead and fade that on down? Thank you. And I want to thank the sound guys here, too. We've got some really good crew in here, so definitely thank that. One of the things I did was I called, when we did the conference, I called up the sound company. I said, you realize you're going to be dealing with a whole bunch of engineers, and they are picky SOBs. And he goes, you know, we've been told that. And I said, well, good. I just want to make sure that sticks with you. And also he recorded the old Kansas City Standard, Moton Swing. Everybody played Moton Swing. And Moton Swing, of course, anticipates the swing movement. It's recorded in 1932, originally by the Benny Moton Orchestra, 3 years before the King of Swing really brings swing to the national vernacular. McShann's bright piano introduces the theme of Moton Swing, leading to riffs by the band in the classic Kansas City style. Charlie then jumps in with an assured solo, distinguished by triplets and in the second eight-bar section, and triplet flourishes at the end of the bridge. It really, these recordings first capture these two signatures of his style. Let's hear a little taste of Moton Swing there, Fred. Keep on track here. In the winter of 1941, in February of 1941, Charlie recorded again with the McShann Band. This session was previously unknown until the library received a gift from the family of John Tamino, the band's manager. John Tamino was a longtime friend also, and his son Bobby gave us his collection. And in it were the signed contract from the Hootie Blues session in Texas, for Decca Label, one of the early Charlie Parker signature. And there were a number of acetates in there. Some of them were labeled, some of them were not. And I was really delighted to find this particular recording. Of course, I knew that Bird was with the group at this time. And it's interesting because this is just 2 months before they go into the studio and make those great Decca recordings, which mostly were blues, small ensemble recordings. And this shows a different side of the McShann Band, a side that probably played at a place like this, in hotels like this, country clubs, college dances, played popular standards of the day. He solos briefly on Margie, but then he really stretches out, Bird really stretches out on Sentimental Over You. And Joe Coleman was with the band at the time. This is before Walter Brown joined the band, before he was recruited for the session. And I think once that Tamino and Jay heard these recordings, Tamino liked gadgets. He had one of the first tape recorders in town, so he was probably the one that recorded it. He fancied himself to be a recording engineer. So we're going to hear something, well, that no one's ever heard, that very few people have ever heard. Carl Woidak, I sent a copy to him, and he was just blown away by this particular performance. And it is really interesting because it's kind of schmaltzy, Sentimental Over You, and then Bird takes flight. And Coleman introduces the theme with a 32-bar vocal rendered in the popular style of the day, and then Charlie steps up with a brilliant lyrical 32-bar solo capped off with a four-bar coda. Charlie peppers his opening bars of his solo with 32nd note flourishes and then glides along propelled by a fleet run of 16th notes. His striking original solo reveals his formidable technique and his maturity as a soloist. Thing about it is, too, when you're listening to these recordings, basically he's playing bebop. Bebop has not entered doesn't enter the nation vernacular until 1945 and 1946. So this is, 3 years ahead of that, 4 years ahead of that. Let's hear, I'm getting sentimental over you. Yeah, track five, please. This disc was in very rough shape and been played quite a bit.
Never thought I'd fall, but now I hear love call. I'm getting sentimental over you. Things you say and do just thrills me through and through. I'm getting sentimental over you. I thought I was happy, I could live without love. Now I must admit, love is all I'm thinking of. Won't you please be kind and just think of your mind? That you be sweet and gentle, be gentle with me, because I'm sentimental over you.
You know, when Charlie would take flight like that, they would just say, "Let it roll." I mean, you know, it's such a mashup of styles, that sentimental vocal, and then you got Bird playing bebop in the middle section there. It reminds me of when this story about when they were at the Savoy Ballroom, and he would be playing Cherokee, and he'd be in chorus after chorus after chorus, and they would say, and Gene Ramey would say, "Just let it roll, man, just let it roll," to the radio station, and they would go over their time because he was continuing to solo. And musicians who heard that went to the Savoy Ballroom and first discovered Charlie Parker. It's a very interesting story. And, you know, Charlie often returned to Kansas City to visit his mother, Addie. And in 1943, between gigs with the Earl Father Hines and the Billy Eckstein Band, Charlie moved back to Kansas City. While in town, he played with bassist Winston Williams at Tootie's Mayfair. This is an ad for Tootie's Mayfair in Kansas City. Notice there's no address, because everybody knew where Tootie's was. Tootie's was out in the county, out past 75th Street, stayed open well till 4 o'clock in the morning, if then, and it was a roadhouse. It was actually a very sophisticated place, and Tootie Clarkin was a retired policeman who fussed over his chickens that he kept in the backyard. And he was quite a character, and Bird could always rely upon Tootie to hire him. And there's lots of great stories about, you know, Bird would do nutmeg. He'd get high on just about anything. And how the store next door came over to Tootie and says, "You must be making a lot of pies with that nutmeg." And Tootie would say, "Nutmeg?" And so he looked around, and he looked underneath the bandstand, and there was an ocean of nutmeg cans underneath the bandstand, where Bird and the other saxophonist had been eating nutmeg to get high. But the band at Tootie's featured Charlie Little Dog Johnson on trumpet, Charlie's local connection for heroin, Edward Little Phil Phillips, who later lost his mind and spent the rest of his life in St. Joseph Insane Asylum, Buddy Anderson, Lucky Enoys, along with Charlie's pianist of choice, Edward Sleepy Hickox. There's a very interesting figure in Kansas City history, who Mary Lou Williams said played as much piano as Art Tatum in all the hard keys, A natural, B natural, E natural. Trumpeter Buddy Anderson, in an interview, recalled the band as being one of the first bebop bands. Anderson reported Bird had come out of Earl Hines' band. This group was taken over by Winston Williams for an engagement at Tootie's Mayfair. It was an extremely interesting little combo with Little Dog, Bird, and another sax, Sleepy Hickox, and Little Phil. Bird was writing charts. We soon had a reputation as one of the first bop groups in the country with traveling bands. Now, while in Kansas City at this time, this is up on the internet, but this is what the label looked like. This is from the Norm Sax Collection. He owns the original. It was recorded in Damon's studio. We have the Damon log. It's been digitized. It's available on the web. Unfortunately, he just noted items that he issued on his own label, not recording sessions like this. But you can see where Charlie Parker has already established his name here in Kansas City, because he's listed in full, Effie G. Ware, and then Lil Phil. Effie G. Ware was about 10 years his senior and a guitarist that taught him some of the chord changes. He's not well documented in the tradition. And they recorded, this final performance reveals Charlie at the top of his game with a relaxed, masterful improvisation on one of his favorite songs, Cherokee. It also anticipates the genesis of bop for 2 years. Let's hear Cherokee. This is a wonderful performance. Thank you. there you have Charlie Parker. And of course, shortly after that was recorded, he would go to New York City and return to New York City, join the Billy Eckstine Band, which was the first bebop band, renew his association with Dizzy Gillespie, and help found the bop generation and the bop movement. And it's interesting, just 3 short years, 4 records, and one thing I think is important about what we do as sound archivists is it's on the record. There's no dispute. We have it right here. Thank you. And if we can help you in any way while you're here in Kansas City, let us know if you have any questions. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Chuck. And we'll take questions for Chuck and for Seth at the end of Seth's presentation.